Storytelling Pavilion, live art installations, hands-on workshop tent, and health and wellness pavilion. Free to the entire community. July 27th on the National Mall. DMV Made Festival. Get more information and RSVP today. WBLINC.org/DMVMade.
I'm Wiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, July 23rd. I'm Dave Rabin. It's great to have you with us. I think we have a very interesting and important program for you today. Later in the show, July 2nd marks the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1960, ended the Democratic Party in a very profound way, a very ongoing way, with American University History Professor Dr. Peter Kuznick. But first, the horror unfolding in Gaza continues. We're closing in on 40,000, that's 40,000 Palestinians killed by the Israeli military using American weaponry largely, but the number is undoubtedly far higher. Some say close to 200,000. They can't count all the bodies underneath the rubble. In addition, the killing and appropriation of Palestinian land by Israel in the West Bank continues. It's not just Gaza. And a regional war looms with Hezbollah in Lebanon and even possibly the Houthis in Yemen. With all the drama surrounding Biden's decision to drop out of the presidential race, you might have missed that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has been invited to address a joint session of Congress on Wednesday. This is a very serious invitation to Mr. Netanyahu that is not offered to just anyone. I understand that Winston Churchill did not get just this opportunity, but Mr. Netanyahu did. What exactly was Netanyahu invited for? Why was he invited? What's he likely to say, and what are the prospects for a ceasefire in Gaza? Joining us to discuss these and other important questions is the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft's Anel Schelein, a former State Department officer who resigned in protest over President Biden's support for Israeli military operations in Gaza. Ms. Schelein, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Can you boost your sound? You're sounding pretty remote to me.
Does that sound better?
You know what? It's, yeah. If there's any way you can, you know, when we initially started.
Does that sound better?
Okay. Yeah, I think that's better. Let's go for it. Ms. Schelein, and welcome callers 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. We need to hear from folks. Want to know that you are listening, that you have questions, comments for our important guest today. Anel Schelein, why did you resign from the State Department?
Well, I resigned over the Biden administration's unconditional support for Israel's military operations in Gaza. This was not only due to the horrific effect this was having on Palestinian civilians, but also the ways in which it was violating U.S. laws, specifically the Leahy laws, as well as Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, which says that any foreign government that is blocking U.S. humanitarian aid is no longer eligible to receive U.S. military assistance.
Right. And there's been a very serious question about aid being able to be distributed to the Gazans, the Palestinians. in Gaza. You have a, I think, important and powerful way of describing the actions of Israel in Gaza. You talk about the amount of tons of explosives that have been dropped in Gaza, and compare it to explosive dropped in World War II. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, so thinking about the total tonnage of what Israel has dropped on Gaza, which is a tiny, tiny portion of territory, it's more than 70,000 tons of explosives, which is more than what was dropped on London, Dresden, and Munich, I think, during World War II. So on both sides, both the Allies and the Germans bombing London. And we think of these bombing campaigns as some of the greatest atrocities in terms of, you know, the destruction to total cities and what it took for those cities to recover. And you think about what Israel has done to this tiny portion of territory. I think another instructive figure to think about is the fact that the atom bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was 20,000 tons of explosive force. And again, Israel has dropped 70,000 tons of explosives on Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to get some perspective, because you hear these numbers and they don't necessarily register, but when you compare it, I mean, more tonnage dropped on Gaza than dropped on Hamburg, Dresden in Germany, and London by the Nazis combined in World War II. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary and horrific. You talk about the fastest death rate in a 21st century conflict in Gaza. If you could touch on that.
Yes, I mean, this does reflect the figure you cited, you know, that we're nearing 40,000 official deaths. These are confirmed deaths, but that we also are aware of so many more deaths that have not been recorded officially. The
right.
Likely close to 200,000 civilians killed, trapped under rubble, those that are starving currently. And we also know that polio is yet a new threat to the civilian population of Gaza, that the IDF is providing boosters, polio vaccine boosters to their soldiers because of their concern that they might be exposed to this deadly disease in Gaza, rather than acknowledging that, well, if they allowed for the treatment of sewage, you wouldn't have to deal with the threat of polio. It just speaks to the horrific nature of this conflict, and to your point about the fastest death rate recorded in a 21st century conflict. It's also the fastest starvation rate ever recorded. And this is because Israel controls everything that goes in and out of Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, we're the fastest rate of starvation ever recorded. I mean, it just gives you pause. We're talking about non-combatants here largely. I mean, if Israel would respond by saying, well, Hamas is hiding amongst the civilian population, that's not necessarily an excuse, I think we can say.
I think that's a crucial point to draw here, and it is something that you do hear the Israeli government speaking about frequently. They use the notion of self-defense because under international law, it would be legal to engage in an act of self-defense. And they also use this notion of Hamas using the civilian population as human shields, because that is also a component of international law, that if combatants are using civilians, you know, if a target such as a hospital, for example, which is protected under international law, if it is shown that it is being used by militants, there is a caveat in international law that does allow for that to be a target. And so what we're seeing is Israel declaring the entirety of Gaza to be a human shield, essentially, that there is no residence, there is no hospital, there is no mosque or church, or even an open field. We saw Israel bombing areas where they have driven Palestinian civilians, where they're simply camped in open agricultural areas, Al-Mawasi, for example, that, you know, that is considered, where it is evident that there is no Hamas presence there, and yet they are justifying bombing those areas. I think what is especially horrifying here is that the system of international laws was put in place after World War II and after the Holocaust to try to prevent those horrors from ever happening again, both the genocide against Jewish people and just those horrific bombings in Hamburg, in London, the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the world said that was not an acceptable way to wage war and set up a system of international institutions to try to prevent that. And yet instead, we're seeing Israel using international laws and saying that the entire population of Gaza constitute human shields and are therefore legitimate targets for them, which is patently false.
Yeah. So you felt there was no way that you could stay within the State Department. Some would say, hey, you should have stayed there. You know, we need people within these institutions to work, from within. There's folks outside doing their best, but boy, it's good to have someone with a conscience being inside, but you it became untenable. I mean, you lasted several months, like almost a half year since October, since the Hamas attack. But it was obviously a little bit too much, and not a challenge that you could overcome.
Exactly. I did try to do what I could on the inside. I co-authored a dissent cable. I signed two other dissent cables. I engaged in internal fora that the State Department held. I spoke with my superiors, and I was one of many people inside the State Department voicing these kinds of concerns, grave concerns, not only for what this was doing to the civilian population of Gaza, but what this was doing to my work on human rights. I was working in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor's Office of Near East Affairs, trying to work on the issues of human rights in the Middle East, which became entirely impossible in the context of Israel's war on Gaza. The U.S. has lost all credibility as an advocate for human rights. So I stayed, as you said, for about 6 months, and then decided that I really couldn't live with myself anymore, and that it seemed that going public was perhaps the only way I could try to shift the needle on these horrific policies.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that you have the Quincy Institute, from which you had come, I believe, before the State Department, and you've returned. It's great that there are institutions like the Quincy Institute to support folks with concerns such as yours. What do you say to those that say that Hamas and its backer Iran wanted Israel to invade? I mean, even someone like Tom Friedman of the New York Times, who was a cheerleader for the Iraq invasion, says, you know, he said it right after October 7th. You know, Israel needs to really pause and think, you know, what does Israel's enemies want it to do? They want Israel to go in there in a futile effort to wipe out Hamas. They'll become a pariah state. They'll stay in the United States for supporting them. What do you think? I mean, didn't Israel, in fact, fall into a trap in going into Gaza in the manner that it has?
I would certainly agree with that. We've seen the ways in which the entire world condemns Israel and the United States on this. And there's been fairly shocking reporting about the ways that this is impacting Israel's economy in terms of foreign direct investment, even ways in which, because, for example, the fact that although Israel relies on natural gas for electricity, when demand is too high, it does burn coal, and it buys most of that coal from Colombia. And the Colombian government has come out and condemned what Israel is doing and is no longer selling them coal. And so Israel is now, you know, the so-called startup nation, which prides itself on its tech sector, is looking at possible brownouts and blackouts because it doesn't have enough electricity. So again, although the primary concern here is what is being done to the civilian population of Gaza, for those who are primarily concerned about Israel, Israeli interests, or about U.S. interests, this is not serving the state of Israel. It is not serving U.S. interests, and primarily because by providing this unconditional support, Biden and the U.S. government are encouraging Israel to expand the war. We saw Israel attack the Iranian facility in Damascus. We've seen them firing rockets across the border at Hezbollah. And to be clear, Israel is responsible for 83% of the trans-border explosives. So Hezbollah does return some fire, but in terms of the proportionality, Hezbollah is responsible for only 17% of those rockets crossing the border. So what I expect to hear Bibi Netanyahu say in his address to Congress is that he wants more money and more weapons so he can go after Hezbollah and expand this war in a way that would almost certainly drag in the United States, because Biden and the U.S. government continue to provide this unconditional support, as has Congress. I think that it is far too much of an automatic response to simply bend the knee to Israel to provide whatever the Israeli government demands, and that the time has come for the U.S. to really reconsider that and think about the ways that this is not in U.S. interests, especially not to get bogged down in yet another unnecessary war in the Middle East. Ask really searching questions about to what extent do Bibi Netanyahu's interests align with the United States, because from my perspective, Bibi is primarily trying to keep himself out of jail. He's accused of corruption. He is trying everything to avoid losing his seat as prime minister, because then that would open him up to possibly going to jail. So his actions in driving this war are likely to get many Israeli civilians killed, because Hezbollah is a much more powerful force than Hamas. It's possible it could drag in Iran. This could become a regional conflagration, which again would absolutely drag in the United States, which is what Israel wants. And what the Gulf states want, they would also love to fight Iran to the last American, similar to what Bibi Netanyahu wants, is to take on Iran or take on Hezbollah to the last American. And so I very much hope that if Kamala Harris is the nominee, or whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee, that they will listen to what the majority of the American people are saying and end this unconditional support for what has credibly been described as Israel committing a genocide against the people of Gaza.
Right. I mean, I think people get caught up on the word genocide. I mean, it's a mass slaughter, you know, however you want to frame it, whether it's technically a genocide in terms of intent, you know, that's hard to prove. But it is certainly an inappropriate mass slaughter of Gazans. You know, you keep hearing about these ongoing negotiations between Israel and Hamas. It seems to me it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, Netanyahu is not going to agree to this because if he agrees to a ceasefire, he loses his support. He loses his government. We're talking about a parliamentary system, unlike what we have in the United States. His coalition is extraordinarily conservative. very, very right-wing. If he agrees to a ceasefire, he's in serious political trouble. We all keep hearing about the possibility of a ceasefire, but it's not going to happen. I guess there's a possibility of it happening with the Knesset going out of session at the end of the month, and Netanyahu could conceivably run a deal, because you can't lose your government in the parliamentary system in Israel if the Knesset, the parliament, is not in session. I'm asking too many questions. Your thoughts?
First, I do want to address the ceasefire negotiations as essentially political theater. We see Secretary Blinken, we see CIA Director Bill Burns, we see Brett McGurk and Jake Sullivan, and all of these top U.S. officials have been shuttling back and forth to the Middle East since October, pretending that the U.S. does not have a massive amount of leverage over Israel, and pretending that the U.S. is doing everything it can to negotiate a ceasefire, when really the United States could say, Israel, it is violating our laws to continue to send you military aid when you are blocking U.S. humanitarian assistance. It is violating our laws to continue to send units of the Israeli military that are credibly accused of gross violations of human rights, military assistance that under U.S. law, those are the Leahy laws, that they are no longer eligible to receive U.S. assistance. This was what the controversy with the NSM-20 that came out and that prompted my State Department colleague Stacey Gilbert to resign, because under that report, they had determined that Israel was indeed blocking U.S. humanitarian assistance, thereby rendering them ineligible to receive these billions of dollars of military assistance. And yet, and when the final report was published, it had changed. That was not what Stacey and her colleagues had written. And so Stacey resigned over it, over the fact that the State Department was lying so blatantly. I think that in general, what you were saying about perhaps he would agree to a ceasefire when the Knesset is out of session. I've heard rumors that perhaps he'll try to use this opportunity to come speak to Congress as a way of demonstrating to the Israeli public that he has not lost U.S. support. The Israelis know the extent to which they continue to depend on the U.S. 78% of Israeli weapons come from the United States. And he's trying, and in general, we know that the protests on college campuses really scared many in Israel who see the way that bipartisan U.S. support for unconditional aid for Israel is splintering. And they fear that's because of what Netanyahu has been doing. So he's going possibly to try to use this visit before Congress to overcome that impression. But still, we know 72% of the Israeli public is opposed to Netanyahu, and they want him to step down. So I'm really appalled that after Chuck Schumer came out and very courageously said publicly that he felt that it was time for elections and time for a different leader to take over for Netanyahu, then he completely flip-flopped and joined Republicans in inviting Netanyahu for, as you said, a record. He's addressed Congress now more than anyone else in history, including Winston Churchill. So I one other clarification I want to make here is that what's currently being discussed as a ceasefire is actually not a real ceasefire, because even if there is some reduction in violence, Netanyahu is insisting on being able to continue to go after these so-called high-value targets. And so the effect would likely be not very different from what we're observing at the moment. And so Netanyahu and Biden might be able to say, yeah, we brokered a ceasefire, when in fact, the violence would simply continue. What those listening, if this is something you care about, and I know in D.C. it's sort of it's frustrating when people suggest you call your member of Congress, since in D.C. we don't have real congressional representation. But, you know, reach out to friends who do have congressional representation and tell them to call their representatives and say that you want them to call for a real ceasefire, an end to all violence, and an end to this unconditional military support for Israel, which would simply mean upholding American laws that are currently being violated.
Yeah. I mean, you say that 72% of Israelis are opposed to Netanyahu, but if we get rid of Netanyahu, the Israelis get rid of Netanyahu, the Israelis themselves, I believe I have this right, correct me if I'm wrong, majority of Israelis oppose aid going into Gaza. I mean, you've got a problem with the Israeli population in general that's not going to go away even when Netanyahu leaves the stage. Your thoughts on that?
That is definitely true. I've been shocked to see the numbers of Israelis trying to block humanitarian aid getting into Gaza. To my understanding, this goes against fundamental tenets of Judaism, that you need to feed those that are hungry. I myself am not Jewish, so I don't claim any expertise on this, but this is what I've heard Jewish colleagues comment on. It is truly shocking what the Israeli public seems to favor at the moment, which, as you say, is to continue to block aid to Gaza. This problem did not start on October 7th, and a huge part of what's unfortunately happened in Israel is that because the U.S. continues to provide billions of dollars of support every year, and this year, you know, an additional, just massive and massive amounts of money, the Israeli public has gotten to a place where they think that they can, that this is acceptable, that sort of the dehumanization of Palestinians, the treatment of Palestinians as completely expendable is something that they have not really had to grapple with. This came out of the post-Oslo process, whereby you saw a much greater system of apartheid being implemented, where Jewish Israelis were completely separated from Palestinians, and Arab, you know, Israelis of Arab descent are second-class citizens. And in general, because the U.S. has not, in fact, acted to push Israel and has instead enabled Israel at every turn, the Israeli public is accustomed to getting whatever they want and not having to compromise. I do think that October 7th shattered this illusion of security, that Israel could maintain this policy of such extreme violence and repression against Palestinians and get away with it and sort of exist in security. In general, I think part of what is so maddening here is any time we see any kind of resistance from Palestinians, resistance to their own annihilation, they are described as terrorists. And the narrative is, well, the U.S. has to protect Israelis. Israel is so crucial to American interests. And that is not true. Israel is not crucial to American interests. In many ways, Israel has driven the United States to adopt very foolish policies. I wrote about this morning with my colleague Adam Weinstein at Quincy, that in previous addresses to Congress, Bibi did things like push for the Iraq war or argue against the Iran nuclear deal, which at the time was the only thing constraining Iran's nuclear program. So we know that when, you know, that this tendency by American politicians to conflate U.S. and Israeli interests is not driven by a clear assessment of the facts. Instead, it is driven by the power of the Israel lobby, the force of which we just saw on display with its successful effort to defeat Congressman Jamal Bowman because of his criticism of Israel. So when people posit that, well, it's in U.S. interest to support Israel, I would just say, look at the facts and look at what Israel is pushing for and look at what actually serves U.S. interests, which is not to get dragged into yet another war in the Middle East.
Yep. I should say, I'm speaking with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Anel Sheline, a former State Department officer who resigned in protest over President Biden's support for Israeli military operations in Gaza. We've got to watch our time. We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to get to talking about AIPAC and other organizations that are supporting, I think, the positions of the leadership in Congress and elsewhere in supporting Israel. But real quickly, what do you think about the prospects for war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, with the Houthis in Yemen? I mean, the Houthis just hit a building in Tel Aviv and Israel retaliated. We could have a three-front war with Israel against its Iranian-backed opponents pretty darn soon. Your thoughts?
I mean, just to be clear, the Houthis hit a single building in Tel Aviv, and Israel responded by blowing up the port at Hodeidah, which is where the vast majority of food and goods come into northern Yemen, where the population of Yemen lives. So although the Houthis themselves are in many ways, you know, eager to benefit from this conflict and portraying themselves as standing up for the people of Gaza in ways that sort of obfuscate their own, the ways that they engage in gross violations of human rights, they are very cleverly using this conflict to enhance their own legitimacy on the global stage, because they are the only actor that has been taking actions, namely blockading the Israeli port of Eilat in the Red Sea by not allowing many ships to pass. Specifically, you know, they're trying to target Israeli ships. Sometimes they go after other ships. But in general, you know, the Houthis have been eager to get involved in a way that Hezbollah has not. The leaders of Hezbollah have demonstrated significant restraint, in part because they have fought wars with Israel before, and they would prefer not to do it again. When Hamas attacked on October 7th, neither Hezbollah nor Iran were aware of what was coming, and the leadership of both made clear from the beginning that October 7th was not our idea. We were not behind this, and we're not going to get involved unless Israel makes it such that they can no longer continue to ignore attacks. We know that Iran very highly values Hezbollah, and if Israel is going after Hezbollah, it is very likely that Iran would get involved. I think that the more concerning element of this is the ways that the United States, because Biden continues to provide this unconditional support, it has made Bibi think that, well, of course the United States is going to back us when we go after Hezbollah, or even if we go after Iran, rather than Biden making abundantly clear to Israel that, look, we will provide you with defensive weapons for Iron Dome, but if you provoke a war with Hezbollah, that's on you. You get to do that by yourself. And that would help signal and help restrain Israel in order to prevent this broader regional war.
Yep. So important to cover this. I mean, there's a risk of a regional war that could conceivably bring in actual boots on the ground for the United States. That's a serious concern. We have a caller. Thank you so much for checking in your name, if you care to, where you're calling from, and your question or comment.
Comment.
Yeah. So important.
Go ahead with your comment.
Thank you. excuse me, yes. Just, I have a few things to say. First of all, allowing Netanyahu in a just world would be indicted, prosecuted, and found guilty of war crimes to enter our halls of Congress is a disgrace. I appreciate your guests. It's been really enlightening. I feel this is the most revealing event in my 70-plus years of lifetime. And, you know, there's no other issue that has revealed where people stand, where our political structure stands. There's no wiggle room. Like there climate change, where you can say you support green deals and whatever, but you wiggle out of it by taking money from oil companies or whatever. So I feel it's just really shown us what our political structure is all about. Regarding genocide, quickly, I'd like to know what elements are missing from what we're witnessing that would constitute a genocide. In other words, if what we're seeing is not genocide, what is missing from that equation?
I appreciate you checking in. Maybe why don't I reframe it just a little bit, and I think it goes to your main point, your main concern, and appreciate you checking in. Why do you think the United States at this incredible moment is inviting Netanyahu to speak to a joint session of Congress? Why are we continuing virtually unabated? There was a brief pause of the big weaponry on the eve of the invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. But why, what is the power behind virtually unconditional support for Israel, in your opinion?
I appreciate the caller's is the third rail in U.S. politics, that it is the issue that ends career, it ends political careers, it ends academic careers. This is the thing that you really have to get in line on and say you support Israel or you risk being taken out. As you know, that you will no longer be someone seen as fit for sort of public office or a career in journalism, for example. Many careers have been ended over this. I do think that that is changing. I think that as a generation, we will see the protests on college campuses demonstrate the ways in which this bipartisan support for Israel will come to an end. I just fear that it is not happening soon enough to make a difference for the people in Gaza.
So we're talking about AIPAC. We're talking about other organizations that are pumping something like $100 million into our electoral system. This is an outside entity, essentially. I mean, AIPAC is technically American-based, but we're talking about an outside government, in essence, affecting our American politics in a very profound way. I mean, the defeat of Mr. Bowman, Congressman Bowman, in New York is just one example. There's other examples, and there's people that are operating in a certain way because they're afraid of AIPAC and its allies, what they would do if they didn't support Israel. I mean, one has to think of Mr. Senator Fetterman from Pennsylvania. Who knows the motivations, but that's just one example. We're running out of time. Is there any possibility of any kind of serious change with the ascendancy of Kamala Harris to the nomination of the Democratic Party? I believe I just saw that she addressed AIPAC in 2017. It's hard to imagine that any serious politician on that level, except with exceptions like Bernie Sanders, is in any way questioning the power of AIPAC, the power of Israel in American politics.
Well, first, I just wanted to respond quickly to the caller's point or question about what would constitute a genocide, and just to clarify that there's a legal definition, and so people disagree, but the ICJ did determine that South Africa's accusations of Israel of being engaged in genocide are credible. But to your point about what could we expect from Harris as a possible nominee, I can only hope that, especially given the political map and what we saw with the uncommitted vote of the many, many Americans, not only Muslim Americans, but many, many hundreds of thousands of Americans who voted uncommitted, that this is a crucial issue. Again, it may not swing the whole election, but it could swing the vote of many of these people. And I do think that the need for a new direction on this is something that could, a case that could be made very clearly from a little, a political perspective, to say that it is not in U.S. interest to get dragged into yet another war, and that is what Israel wants. I sincerely hope that this is what Kamala Harris will do, that she will take the position that it is time for new U.S. policy towards Israel, one that does not aid and abet this genocide. But let's just say I'm not optimistic. I don't know that we're quite there yet politically. I do think we are heading there. It's just a question of, will Harris pay attention to what the American people want? Again, the majority of Americans say they oppose the way this policy is being enacted and unconditional support for Israel, what Israel is doing. I hope she listens to voters on this and many issues in a way that Biden clearly was not.
Yep. We're going to have to end it there. I've been speaking with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and Nell Schelein. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for all you're doing. How can people follow your work?
They can find me on Twitter at Nell Schelein. They can find my work at the Quincy Institute. I just, you know, really want to extend my appreciation for WPFW and you and all the important issues that you cover at this and so many others. Really appreciate that Washington has this resource. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your work and your time. I should note, a protest by various groups opposing Israel's war in Gaza and Netanyahu's address to Congress will be held between 10:30 and 1:30 tomorrow, Wednesday, at John Marshall Park, Pennsylvania Ave and 4th Street Northwest. That's Pennsylvania Ave and 4th Street Northwest. Go to copink.org for more information. And on to our last interview. July 2nd marks the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's a landmark civil rights law that outlaws discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. It prohibits racial segregation in schools and public accommodation and employment discrimination. The act remains one of the most significant legislative achievements in American history. But it provoked a backlash among Southern Democrats that led to Republican dominance in the South that lasts to this day. And joining us to talk about the Civil Rights Act is American University history professor Dr. Peter Kuznick, co-author, along with Oliver Stone, of The Untold. Dr. Kuznick, it's great having you with us.
Good to see you, David.
I really appreciate it. So the Civil Rights Act, an impressive piece of legislation. It took the legislative skill and courage, I think we can say, of President Lyndon Johnson to get it through. He did it before his election in 1964. There were aides, they were telling him, you know, Mr. President, just wait till you win the election in 64, then you can do this kind of extremely adventurous, risky legislation. And he said, well, what's the point of being president if I'm not going to push for this kind of thing? And he went for it. There's an extraordinary play and made into a movie, I think, All the Way with LBJ. I can't recommend it enough, that depicts this whole, the incredible year leading up to the election in 64. Peter Kuznick, if you could talk about this legislation and the courage of Lyndon Johnson. Of course, he's demeaned, you know, rightfully so for the Vietnam War, but domestically he was kind of unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the tragic legacy of Lyndon Johnson. As a domestic reformer, he was head and shoulders above Joe Biden, who gets so praised for what he's been able to achieve domestically now. Lyndon Johnson was truly a giant in that regard. But he realized the timing. You know, this comes in the aftermath of the Birmingham uprising in 1963, and Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And it comes in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination. And Kennedy had introduced legislation in June of 1963, and Johnson realized that he could make this a tribute to Kennedy's legacy. And when he introduced it, he started talking about this within days of becoming president, and he said that this is going to be John Kennedy's legacy, and we have to pass it as a tribute to John Kennedy. Now, Kennedy, for all the great things that I could say about him, was somewhat wishy-washy when it came to civil rights. Kennedy had not been a stalwart, and for the same reason that Roosevelt wasn't. America's two great presidents of the 20th century, Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy, both were political pragmatists, and they understood that a big part of the electoral strength of the Democrats was the controlling the South. And the Democrats controlled pretty much the entire South at that point. And it's for that reason that Roosevelt did not support the anti-lynching bill, even though he felt strongly about it privately, even though his wife, Eleanor, was out there very publicly. And Kennedy was very, very hesitant to push forth civil rights, even though he thought what was happening in terms of the resistance to civil rights was outrageous. Robert Kennedy was in some ways more out front than his brother when it came to civil rights. And Robert was attorney general at that point. But finally, Kennedy makes a very important speech to the nation on June 11th, talking about the importance of real equality in terms of what this country's supposed to stand for. And the next day, Medgar Evers is assassinated in Mississippi. So, wow. Kennedy was very hesitant about the March on Washington in August of 63. He thought it would polarize the country in a way that would undermine his civil rights legislation. But he met with the leaders before and after. Well, he met with them right after the march and did pledge support, but he didn't have time to get it through before he was assassinated in November. But Johnson picked up the ball and ran with it. And that's that, and the rest of his domestic agenda really would be a great tribute to Johnson if he hadn't. You were just talking about the slaughter in Gaza. Well, whatever the number is, whether it's 40,000 dead or close to 200,000 dead, you know how many Vietnamese died in the war? When Robert McNamara came into my class, he said that he believed that 3.8 million Vietnamese died.
We're not even talking about Laotians or Cambodians.
No, those are
close to 4 million Vietnamese.
Vietnamese. And when I was in Hanoi in January of this year, the leaders in Vietnam now use the 5 million figure. As appalling, as horrifying as what Netanyahu and the Israelis are doing in Gaza, it pales in comparison with what the United States did in Vietnam. And so that's the legacy, and it's not only polarized the country, it's so diminished Johnson's stature as an historical figure. I remember during the anti-war marches that Kamala Harris's parents participated in. And when she brought her as a baby, the chants were, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? And Lyndon, pull out like your father should have. Those were the two principal chants. It's the ugliest, one of the ugliest parts of American history that Vance says we should be so proud of.
Yeah, I mean, getting back to domestic politics, it was one of the great revelations for me to understand in the New Deal that the Democratic Party was essentially Southern-based and racist. you know, as reflected by, you know, people of color couldn't get mortgages. There was redlining in the 30s. Yeah. You know, what
housing policy was outrageously bad.
Right. I mean, it's and which goes to an extraordinary extent understanding the disparity in wealth in this country. You know, if you don't own a house, your chances of, you know, accumulating wealth are seriously diminished for the middle class. And the Democratic Party, and that lasted into the 60s. And I'm bringing this up, and we're just about out of time, but I'm bringing this up to say that LBJ not only was individually politically courageous in doing this before the 64 election, but I think Bill Moyers tells the story of going over to the White House after the Civil Rights Act passed, and LBJ was in bed with newspapers over his head. And Moyers goes, you know, what is your problem, Mr. President? You know, you've just won this incredible victory. And he says, I've lost the South for a generation for the Democratic Party. It wasn't an accident. He knew what he was doing and went against his main mentor, the senator from Georgia, Richard Russell, who has a building up on the hill named after him. You know, and it's incredible guts, incredible chutzpah, if you will. But he did it, and you know, I don't know if we can say that he paid the price, but the Democratic Party paid the price. Nixon's Southern strategy, Ronald Reagan talking about states' rights and kicking off his 1980 campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers were murdered. I mean, you know, he was cogent and correct in what would happen.
Yeah, it's too bad. And the South, in many ways, has never recovered. And the country has never recovered. You know, one of the things that's amazing about that legislation and the victory there was that it was bipartisan. You had many Republicans supporting the civil rights legislation, and you had many Democrats opposing it. How could we, not only was it monumental in scale and historically so significant, but it showed a much deeper commitment to the American ideal of equality before the law than we have today. And not only with the immunity ruling by the Supreme Court, but in terms of the Republican Party as a bastion of white supremacy today. And you can see even the early attacks on Kamala Harris as a DEI candidate. I mean, deeply entrenched in the racism that makes the ugly Republican Party so ugly today.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can safely say that this is not the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln is turning over in his grave. I mean, it is Mr. Trump's party. It's Christian nationalist, racist writ large.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. We've got a minute left. So what do you think about the ascendancy of Kamala Harris? Appears that she has enough delegates to get the nomination. Any thoughts?
She's got
it. Just have a minute left.
It's a fait accompli. She's got it. You know, I was appalled that Biden hung on as long as he did. And what I was saying was the future of this country, the future of the Western world, the future of life on our planet may rest in the hands of an 81-year-old mentally challenged narcissist, his wife, a community college English teacher, and his son, a convicted felon, former drug addict. These three people were the cocoon around him. The one thing I don't like is that the leaders of the Biden campaign are now moving over and leading the Harris campaign. I don't like the taint. I don't like the role that they played. I don't like that they encouraged him to stay in. I don't like that they lied to the American people. So Harris is head and shoulders superior to Trump and Vance under any and all circumstances. But I hope she breaks with many aspects of Biden's foreign policy. I hope she chooses diplomacy over more fighting in Ukraine. And I hope she stops giving any weapons to Israel at this point. Is it possible, given her background? I don't know, but there's at least a chance now if we push her in the right direction.
Let us pray, and perhaps the politics of the situation will guide her in that way. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Kuznick, American University History Professor. I really appreciate you joining us today. It's so informative.
Always fun to be with you, David.
It's great having you. Thanks. Take care. Thanks to Magic Mike for his engineering expertise. Coming up, the WPFW news headlines, followed by the unbelievably wonderful Don't Forget the Blues with Lady Muir. And thank you so much for being with us. Stay safe. Have a great week.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Vice President Kamala Harris makes her first presidential campaign event today, visiting the swing state of Wisconsin. She's already garnered enough delegate support to win the Democratic Party's nomination, according to a tally by the Associated Press. Harris, who would be the nation's first woman and Indian American president, raised a record $100 million since Sunday when President Joe Biden dropped out of the race and endorsed her. In a preview of Harris's readiness to win, she spared no punches against Republican Donald Trump in a speech to campaign staff Monday. Christopher Martinez reports.
Donald Trump wants to take our country backward to a time before many of our fellow Americans had full freedoms and rights. But we believe in a brighter future that makes room for all Americans.
Kamala Harris was at campaign headquarters.
Before I was elected as vice president, before I was elected as United States Senator, I was the elected Attorney General, as I've mentioned, of California. And before that, I was a courtroom prosecutor. In those roles, I took on perpetrators of all kinds. Predators who abused women. Fraudsters who ripped off consumers. Cheaters who broke the rules for their own gain. So hear me when I say, I know Donald Trump's type.
Biden phoned in.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be out there in the campaign with her, with Kamala. I'm going to be working like hell. You know, what we still need to save is democracy. And Trump is still a danger to the community. He's a danger to the nation.
Party officials say they plan to select the next nominee virtually sometime before August 7th. That's a deadline involving an Ohio ballot issue. Reporting for Pacifica Radio, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Republicans are pledging legal action over the allocation of Biden's campaign funds to Harris's campaign. Before Biden bowed out, they also floated the idea of suing to keep him on the ballot. Catherine Carley reports.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says the more than 14 million voters who backed Biden in the primaries should not be disenfranchised.
It would be wrong and I think unlawful in accordance to some of these states' rules for a handful of people to go in a back room and switch it out because they don't like the candidate any longer.
Republicans are also calling on Biden to resign, saying if he's not fit to run, he's not fit to serve. Former President Donald Trump has kept up attacks on social media, claiming without proof that Biden's advisors hid the truth about his health and calling his COVID diagnosis a fake excuse to drop out. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in the U.S. to address a joint session of Congress tomorrow, Wednesday. Protests are planned in opposition to Israel's war in Gaza, the high civilian death toll, and humanitarian crisis. A growing number of lawmakers are pledging to boycott Netanyahu's address. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat, said on social media he'll skip it and quote, Netanyahu's war strategy killed 12,000. Women and children, inflicted widespread starvation, and prioritized his political survival over the release of hostages. He should not have a platform before Congress, unquote. Vice President Kamala Harris will reportedly not attend Netanyahu's address, but will meet with him privately. It's unclear whether Biden will, as he's recovering from COVID. Netanyahu's now signaling a ceasefire deal could be taking shape that would free dozens of hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. Hamas is pushing for a ceasefire that ends the war. Palestinian political factions have formed a unity government after meeting in China. It includes Fatah, Hamas, and 12 other organized parties. The move comes after the International Court of Justice ruled Israel's settlements on land seen as a future Palestinian state violate international law. In Illinois,